What's University Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump says he's made a decision on the future of the International Iranian Nuclear Agreement, but declined to tell reporters in New York what that decision was. The president, who has been highly critical of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, has until October 15th to inform Congress whether Tehran remains in compliance. Vice President Mike Pence earlier told the UN Security Council that Iran remains a menace in the Middle East.
The world's leading state sponsor of terrorism continues to flout the spirit of the Iran deal, destabilizing the region and brazenly threatening the security of sovereign nations.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani in New York was asked about the U.S. position. He said any country that tries to back out of the agreement would do so nothing more than embarrass itself. The Iranian leader said the JCPOA will remain as is or it will no longer exist. During his U.N. speech, Mr. Rouhani said Iran would not be the first country to violate the deal. Meanwhile, General John Hyten, the head of the U.S. Strategic Command, said Wednesday that Iran is operating under the nuclear agreement, but also rapidly deploying and developing a series of ballistic missiles of all ranges, posing a challenge to the U.S. and its allies. Togolese security forces Wednesday opened fire on anti-government protesters, demanding an end to the rule of President Faure Gnassingbé. Rights groups say one boy was killed, more than two dozen other people wounded. Tensions remain high since protests first erupted last month over an effort to reimpose a two-term limit on presidents. The Gnassingbé family has ruled the country since independence 50 years ago. Tuesday, Parliament failed to approve a measure providing for term limits. This is VOA News. The leaders of the U.S. and South Korea are expected to meet Thursday on the sidelines of the U.N. General Assembly meeting in New York on North Korea following President Trump's warning the U.S. is prepared to destroy the North if it threatens the U.S. or its allies. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe Wednesday devoted his U.N. General Assembly speech on the threat posed by Pyongyang. Mr. Abe warned Pyongyang's nuclear weapons either already are or on the verge of becoming hydrogen bombs, and their means of delivery sooner or later will be intercontinental ballistic missiles. He said now is not the time for dialogue, but to apply pressure. Japan Forum for Strategic Studies senior research fellow Grant Newsham said Mr. Abe's policy closely resembles that of the U.S.
I think Prime Minister Abe realizes that Japan's interests and his interests are in staying as close to the Americans as possible. And what he said does align with what Mr. Trump has said.
Last week, North Korea fired a missile over Japan for a second time this year. In Myanmar, several hundred Buddhists Thursday tried to block an aid shipment to Muslims in Rakhine State. Police had to fire warning shots and made several arrests. Wednesday, Vice President Pence called for strong and swift U.N. action to end nearly a month of violence following insurgent attacks on security forces that prompted a crackdown.
And now we're witnessing a historic exodus. Over 400,000 Rohingya, including tens of thousands of children, have now been forced to flee from Burma to Bangladesh, with more following every day.
Myanmar's vice president told the U.N. Wednesday the security situation is actually improving, with no new clashes since September 5th. The Spanish government is preparing for more protests as Catalan separatists take to the streets following a central government crackdown on those behind an October 1st independence referendum. Protests like this took place in Madrid and Barcelona. Police have raided Catalan government offices, arrested local officials, and seized millions of ballot papers to halt the banned vote. The country's highest court suspended the vote as unconstitutional. In Mexico, authorities now say more than 230 people have died following Tuesday's major earthquake in central Mexico that collapsed buildings in Mexico City. Rescuers are working around the clock to locate survivors under the rubble. Although downgraded to a Category 4 hurricane, Maria lashed the Caribbean island of Puerto Rico Wednesday with winds in excess of 200 kilometers per hour, plunging the U.S. territory of 3.4 million into darkness. The storm has caused widespread flooding and has left at least nine dead on its course through the Caribbean. And U.S. stocks remained in record territory Wednesday after U.S. policy bank makers held off for now, raising a key interest rate. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, and today is Thursday, September the 21st, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. A 10-year-old boy was killed and many others were injured in Togo's capital Wednesday as hundreds of thousands of opposition supporters demonstrated against a vote by the parliament on a bill they feared will allow the president for more terms in office. And the Committee to Protect Journalists says that Cameroon has been using its 2014 anti-terror law to silence critics and suppress dissent.
You don't have a right to demand information and get it. A government that really wants a free press does that as one of the first things, because it's then that you begin to hold journalists accountable for the quality of information they put out, because they have every means to collect information correctly.
That's Cameroon's Standard Tribune editor-in-chief, Eugene Fongwa. And in Gambia, a commission of inquiry to look into the financial activities of the former dictator Yahya Jammeh and his government found that millions of the Gambian currency, the dalasis, were withdrawn from the central bank without proper documentation. And various African leaders are in New York this week for the UN General Assembly, including Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe, whose large delegation of more than 70, that includes his wife, children and grandchildren, has been a subject of much talk among Zimbabweans worried about the cost of the trip at a time when the country's economy is struggling.
This shopping thing, they do it at the expense of poor Zimbabwe.
Fortune Lalazi of the opposition People's Democratic Party, led by former finance minister Tendai Biti. Those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. A 10-year-old boy was killed and many others were injured in Togo's capital Wednesday as hundreds of thousands of opposition supporters demonstrated against a vote by the West African Nations Parliament on a bill that they feared would allow the president to run for more terms. Togo's security minister, Damehame Yark, blamed opposition members for the violence, saying that they brought weapons to the demonstrations. Thousands of people across the small West African nation have been demonstrating since last month, asking for term limits on President Faure Gnassingbé, who has been in power since his father died in 2005. The Gnassingbé family has ruled the nation for 50 years. Security forces killed at least two people and injured several others in demonstrations in August. They used tear gas to break up another peaceful protest this month. The ruling party voted Tuesday in favor of a draft bill that the opposition said did not include a sentence outlining term limits for the president. And today is the International Day of Peace, the day which is devoted to strengthen the ideals of peace within and among all nations and people all over the world. Reporter Moses Havyarimana revisits Bujumbura's neighborhood, the hotspot of the 2015 violent protests, 2 years after.
Here in Cibitoke, a Bujumbura neighborhood where protest against President Pierre Nkurunziza took place was considered as one of the most insecure places to be in 2015. Business here have started picking up, as most of the traders here had by then fled due to the violence that claimed more than 500 people. I met Billy, a 45-year-old carpenter. He explains how the situation is like now.
About work is not as it used to be, you know, but at least there are some changes in security-wise, because now, like this area, in 2015 you couldn't enter here, and people couldn't even go on street to do their businesses. But now at least it's fine. But poverty is the main challenge.
Traders in Bujumbura expressed mixed reaction concerning about peace. Regardless being able to do their businesses on streets here, some say that peace comes hand in hand with the financial stability. Ines owns a small grocery here in Cibitoke.
I couldn't work because of the chaos which was here, so I wasn't able to work, but now we thank God that we can at least sit here by the roadside and start working. Peace is something that we should promote because it is everything.
Burundi had enjoyed 10 years of stability since 2005 after the Arusha Agreement came into force in 2000. But the country is yet to find a sustainable peace. Justin Zoisaba is the chairman of the National Dialogue Commission.
So I think we are trying in every corner. The Burundian Dialogue, which is led by MUCAPA, is programmed in October. We hope that this will finish with good result. Peace resides in the heart. A person doesn't have peace himself or herself, it is not easy to give to others peace. So we hope that it will end well.
In Burundi, peace had been advocated in different platforms, especially to disseminate information to the youth. Natasha is a prominent Burundian artist. She says that peace is everything.
Peace advocate, and I love my country, so I always sing about peace because Burundi needs peace and it is the foundation of development. I call on Burundians to come together and be one and put an end to anything that divides us.
The UNHCR and the Burundian government are set to repatriate more than 12,000 Burundian refugees back in the country by the end of this year. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. In the Gambia, a commission of inquiry established by the government of President Adama Barrow to look into the financial activities of the former dictator Yahya Jammeh and his government have found that millions of the Gambian currency, the dalasis, were withdrawn from the central bank without proper documentation. 22 bank accounts were traced to the exiled dictator Yahya Jammeh. Army officers and the State House staffers received money on behalf of Jammeh even after the expiration of his term as president. Three former governors were invited to the commission on Tuesday, Pat Nderimbai reports.
Three fired former governors of the Central Bank of the Gambia have appeared before the Jammeh Commission to give evidence on the 22 bank accounts operated by the former Gambian dictator Yahya Jammeh at the Central Bank. The accounts had to do with government projects in which Mr. Jammeh, in some occasions, was the sole signatory to the accounts. Monies were being withdrawn from the accounts without proper documentation from the recipients. Some of the recipients were close Jammeh confidants and security ADs. Mrs. Ami Bensouda is the lead counsel attached to the Jammeh Commission. Mrs. Bensouda confronted one of the former deputy governors about some of the withdrawals made at the central bank.
And then from Buri LB Escoli, who says he's been directed by His Excellency the President to receive 100,000 euro. Sanajaju, who said he was directed by His Excellency to receive $500,000. And again by Noha Williams. And this was the last transaction on the 3rd of January 2017 this year, which was authorized by yourself for $100,000.
Okay. Miss Umi Samba is a former second deputy governor at the Central Bank of the Gambia. She tells the commission that they couldn't defy the dictator's instructions for fear of possible reprisal.
These were trying times. We just couldn't say no to some of these requests, not even some of them. These requests, we couldn't say no. Verbal. So what we tried to do was to document it. Verbal instructions. Nobody works on verbal instructions. Because a day like today would come. I've been in the bank long enough. I was there for the Angali Commission. We were the ones digging out the documents. So we knew exactly what would happen. We knew that a day like this would come.
Indeed, the day of reckoning has come, but lead counsel Ami Bensouda refused to buy Mrs. Samba's testimony. She said Samba ought to have asked for proper documentation before making the payments. Omi Samba again.
These were people with, I wouldn't say power, but they had authority. That's the sad part of it all. Sometimes I question myself, you know, sitting there with all this education, going through universities and everything, and then you're so helpless, you cannot say no.
Also testifying before the commission was Mr. Basiru Njai, the former first deputy governor at the Central Bank of the Gambia. Mr. Njai reminded the commission members that the Gambia was under dictatorship rule at the time.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is that we were operating in a very abnormal, you know, environment. If you look at the records, it is absolutely, you know, clear that the president had, you know, direct control, you know, of the accounts. Solbagi and company would not have come to the Central Bank of the Gambia if they were not asked by the president, you know, to come and receive cash, you know, on his behalf.
The Janek Commission has been tasked to investigate financial dealings involving former dictator Jammé and his government. The commission has been given 3 months' deadline to complete its mission. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Panderimbay reporting.
The twin threats of climate change and unchecked development endanger indigenous cultures all over the world. To spotlight the challenges and some of the best homegrown solutions, the United Nations Nature for Development Program bestows so-called Equator Prizes. They are awarded to indigenous groups that create the most inspiring and sustainable grassroots development projects. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Jamison Irvin, who manages the Nature for Development Program and oversees its Equator Prize competition.
We're trying to change the way that people think about development. A lot of development that occurs is very short-term thinking. If you cut down a forest to provide timber, in the long term, that's not development because it's not helping the people in the community who depend on forests for their medicines, for their livelihoods, for their fuel.
Yet there still is development to be had and also investment for other people so that they can get a little bit of money out of it while furthering the sort of life goals of these villages and such, right?
Yes, but we have to remember the precept of the Sustainable Development Goals, which is that we will leave no one behind. And this idea of inclusiveness means that you start from the bottom first. You ensure that they have the tools that they need and the nature that they need to achieve their own livelihoods, food needs, and water needs.
Now, I understand you have this Equator Prize, which is part of your Equator Initiative. Can you tell me sort of in a nutshell what that is and maybe some of the people that you've honored this year?
The Equator Prize is a prize established to recognize outstanding local and indigenous communities in their efforts to manage nature sustainably in order to achieve their own goals. We recognized 15 of these communities this year to showcase our 15th anniversary, but they are representative of hundreds and thousands of communities that are taking action on managing nature sustainably for a truly just and inclusive sustainable development.
Give me a sense of the range of the Equator Prize winners this year. I know you've got 2 winners from Kenya and 1 from a very remote region of Mali.
Yes, it's an area that's rife with conflict, of extreme poverty, but they've enabled their youth to establish eco-guards, and they protect the Malian elephant population, which is one of the most endangered in the African continent.
That was Jamison Irvin, manager of the Nature Development Program at the United Nations Development Program. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips this week in connection with the convening of the UN General Assembly in New York. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe is among several world leaders gathered in New York for the 72nd session of the United Nations General Assembly. However, prior to his departure, President Mugabe, who will address the General Assembly, sparked a whirlwind of discussion among Zimbabweans because of his large delegation of more than 70 that includes his wife, children, and grandchildren. VOA Zimbabwe's Gibbs Dube reports.
Critics argue that the delegation reportedly receiving daily stipends of $1,500 each is irresponsible at a time when the country's economy is struggling due to lack of investment and massive unemployment. Making reference to various images showing President Robert Mugabe slipping through discussions, Fortune Mlalazi of the opposition People's Democratic Party, led by former Finance Minister Tendai Biti, said there was no purpose for the Zimbabwean leader being there.
There is only one thing that the president is there to do, that is to slip
or we can substitute it with insulting others. That is the best that the president can do there in New York. He has got no meaningful contribution to the country or to the world.
However, Joseph Chuma, a legislator and member of the ruling ZANU-PF party, dismissed the criticism, saying that President Robert Mugabe is right to attend the meetings as he plays a crucial role at forums such as the United Nations General Assembly.
There are a lot of agreements that take place there. There are so many conventions that have come out of those forums. And for the president to be part of that is very essential. I believe if you remember, back then, there was the issue of the Security Council that the president and some other African leaders stood for until Africa was also recognized. So it is correct for the president to go to those kind of forums so that we advance our cause as Africa and as Zimbabwe in particular. But as Africa, really, we need to engage those people, and they need to see the collective voice of Africa standing up to say, we are equal as well to you. The first world country.
Chuma noted that critics of President Mugabe have no real basis to question the president's trips.
That is right. Even Jesus was criticized. They called him a glutton and a drunkard, yet he was the Messiah. So we don't expect anything less as well. If you are the president, you are in the center of the storm. So those kind of criticisms are bound to come your way.
But Mlalazi said there is no proof of any outcome of the agreements signed or benefits to Zimbabwe.
There are no agreements. No one wants to sign an agreement with Mugabe. Or rather, they must show us some of those agreements and their success. We have seen people coming here promising to come back with investment, but they all disappear.
Further sparking debate about President Mugabe's trip to New York with his family was a picture that went viral Tuesday of son Palamine Chatunga at a McDonald's outlet, and his security aides carrying shopping bags from high-end stores like Gucci. Mlalazi said this is the trend that the first family has been showing for some time.
It doesn't surprise us. You must remember that this whole thing started with the father, then came the mother. Now it is with the children. It's going to also cascade down to the grandchildren. This shopping thing, they do it at the expense of poor Zimbabweans.
But Chuma raised issue with this argument, saying all young kids like high-end merchandise. Chuma said, contrary to belief that the government is paying for the family's expenses, the first family has enough of its resources to foot the bill.
Let's be honest here and sincere. I would wish for my child whatever the best value, I mean, in life, and so would you, so would anybody else. And so if the president's son decides to get something good for himself, and especially also consider that he is not taking money from the fiscals, he is not taking money from government, because you must remember that this very first family that we are talking about is an entrepreneurial family. We know they are running a business here in Zimbabwe.
Mlalazi questioned the productivity levels at Alpha and Omega Company that the family owns, saying many in Zimbabwe cannot afford the company's products.
We know is that that farm, Kushungo Dairy, produces poison, and no one buys that poison. In simpler terms, they are producing ice cream and all those other small things. Zimbabweans cannot afford to buy ice cream. So where are they getting that money from? They cannot sell ice cream and buy Gucci. It doesn't make sense.
President Mugabe, who is contesting in the 2018 presidential election, will address the United Nations General Assembly on Thursday. Reporting for VOA Zimbabwe Service, this is Gibbs Dube in Washington.
This is Daybreak on the Voice of America. And for our final story, Cameroon has been using its 2014 anti-terror law to silence critics and suppress dissent. That's according to a report released by the U.S.-based Committee to Protect Journalists. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaounde.
The Committee to Protect Journalists says Cameroon's government is using a 2014 anti-terrorism law to arrest and threaten media who report on the Boko Haram insurgency or controversial topics like the ongoing strike in English-speaking zones. Bruno Kwemu of the Cameroon Union of Journalists says reporters fear practicing their profession. He says Cameroonian journalists are not criminals. He says his union recommends the strict respect of ethics and professional norms. The Committee to Protect Journalists says at least five journalists in Cameroon have been arrested and charged under the law, which introduced hefty punishments, including the death penalty for involvement or complicity with terrorism. RFI Hausa reporter Ahmed Abba was sentenced to 10 years in prison earlier this year. He was arrested in northern Cameroon, covering the war against Boko Haram. Rights groups say he was tortured during his two-year pre-trial detention. His lawyers are appealing his sentence. Four other reporters arrested under the 2014 law were recently released. They had been detained in relation to their coverage of the government's response to the Anglophone strike. By VOA's count, at least 30 local media outlets have been sealed or suspended over coverage of the unrest since the strike began in December. The government also cut internet access to the two English-speaking regions for 3 months as talk of secession began eclipsing the original strikers' demands. The government has repeatedly defended its actions in response to the strike, saying national security trumps freedom of expression. The Committee to Protect Journalists is urging Cameroon to revise the anti-terror law in line with international standards, decriminalize defamation, and abolish the National Communication Council with an independent regulatory body with narrower powers. The NCC is the state agency responsible for policing the media. VOA spoke to the NCC President Peter Isoka.
There may be an outcry, but these are just people who think that they have a certain aura around them and that nobody can touch them. Listen, it would be erroneous to tell us here that we have a heavy hand on everyone. There is not a single case that we have taken a decision on in which the people concerned are not summoned to the council and probably defend themselves.
Most of the journalists VOA contacted to comment of the Committee to Protect Journalists report declined, stating that they wanted to play safe. Standard Tribune editor-in-chief Eugene Fongwa says journalists in Cameroon find it difficult to do their jobs because the government is not open with information.
You don't have a right to demand information and get it. A government that really wants a free press does that as one of the first things, because it's then that you begin to hold journalists accountable for the quality of information they put out, because they have every means to collect information correctly.
Retired journalist Kome Emmanuel says the intimidation of journalists has scared the public from expressing views in the media, especially during call-in programs.
Under normal circumstances, under normal situation, we'll have more people expressing their points of view. That would have been the ideal, but the government has certain fears.
Asked for comments by VOA, Cameroon's Communication Minister Issa Chiruma described the Committee to Protect Journalists report as baseless. He said journalists in Cameroon are free and that the country will not succumb to external pressure to change laws. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And that's it for this Thursday, September the 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a good day, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next, Straight Talk Africa, fresh off a three-nation Africa visit to the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zambia, and Tanzania. Shaka Sali talks about the fascinating people he met and the challenges he encountered, reporting on democracy in Africa. On the road with Shaka, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.